Deviation.
I have seen the dark shadows moving in the woods, and I have no doubt that whatever I have resurrected through this book is sure to come calling for me.
David, you look absolutely terrific, honestly. You've got like glue on.
This is where the worst begins. This is where we must stop. For beyond is the work of madness. The nightmare of insane murder and lingering death. Get inside and lock your doors. Close your windows.
Someone is watching you. Someone is waiting for you. Someone wants to scare you to death.
This is Albert from The Tuesday Show. You're listening to the goddamn Dave Hill Show, now on a flipping Monday.
We've done it. No, you are an angel witch. We've done it, guys.
Made it.
Did it.
We've done it.
Dez.
How are
Dez
you?
Dez made it. Dez made it in the nick of time.
Under the wire.
Not to show you how the sausage is made, everybody, but there was a flurry of text exchanges. Dez was saying he was going to be late, but as we all saw,
I didn't say late. I said might cut it close.
I'm not here to argue semantics with you. My point is, as we all saw, when the lights went up, Dez was on screen before Christmas.
Yeah, suck it.
That's not a judgment. I'm just stating facts. Anyway, hello and welcome to the Dave Hill Good Time Hour. Now in its 47th exhilarating year. No, I don't know why I said that. I'm Mondays. Anyway, hi, how are you? I'm incredible. Thank you so much for asking. How are you doing, boy criminal Chris Gersbeck?
I'm good. How does the bed music sound?
Sounds great.
Nice.
That's
all I'm concerned about.
You look like you were wearing like some sort of
St. Patrick's Day.
Sort of an 80s power outfit, like a
movie
executive, but yeah, like a sort of a, I don't know what I like, a black mock turtleneck, but now I see it's just a long sleeve t-shirt.
It's just, yeah, it's a black, I'm like really into crew neck sweatshirts right now for some reason.
What is a crew neck sweatshirt? I mean, I know, I would just like to hear you describe it.
It's just like, you know, like a sweat, like a hoodie without the hood, basically.
Oh, yeah. They're very comfortable.
Very comfortable. I used to always hate, I was like so in on hoodies. I was like, I can never wear just a sweatshirt. I think it looks stupid. And now like, I really like the way it looks. I think it's cool.
I think just anyone, whether you're catching this conversation live or in the podcast format, I think the vibe is that it's a cool look.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
I mean, we're all feeling good about it. How are you doing, New Jersey Chicken Rancher Dez?
Doing all right. Little rush this evening, but ready to slide in and relax now for a while. Doing great. We had a chicken scare earlier.
What does that mean? That could mean a lot of things. It could have meant you were scared of a chicken. A chicken was in danger.
A chicken was in danger. Or maybe
okay,
multiple.
That was not what I was hoping to hear. I was hoping, not that I want any harm to come to you or your wife. Definitely not your wife. You, I'd be comfortable with a fair amount of harm coming from a chicken towards you.
Right.
Because I feel like you would survive.
Yeah.
And any humor would be worth it. I don't wish ill upon you. What happened? I feel bad.
I was not home, but Kim was in the yard. Chickens were out ranging. And there was a hawk in the area. It took two passes, but apparently it was a shitty hawk, and he didn't get one. But Kim was able to wrangle the chickens back into the coop quickly. And
that's horrifying.
The hawk? That is horror. I never even thought of that possibility.
Guy that I work with has chickens, and just last week, he's like, man, I just watched this thing come in, grab my little chicken, and just watch it fly away. You know, just nothing I can do.
Do they get other animals? Like cats or dogs or anything?
Probably. I'm sure they take their shots where they see a chance. I mean, chickens are, you know, compared to a hawk, slow and stupid. So, you know, it's easy pickings.
There's some out where I am in this tiny Finnish fishing village. I see hawks and I see eagles. And when they come around, the eagles especially, and I'm guessing it's a different eagle, but the eagle, it's always solo. But the seagulls all go, they're like, we're out. Yeah, we're getting out of here.
Yeah, we had a hawk on the fence last week. Maybe it was the same one, I don't know. Saw him grab a small bird, just, you know, at mid-flight, just jumped at him. So they rule the sky. You got to pay your respects.
Last summer, I watched a hawk disembowel some animal about 10 feet from me. Like, I just sat on the front lawn drinking some coldies, watching this hawk on this branch just gut some animal. And I wasn't going to interfere. It was already dead. So I was like, you know, have at it.
Nature runs its course.
But it was, you know, beautiful animal. I guess you don't call birds animals, do you?
It'd be like calling an insect an animal.
Which is to say it would be insane.
Well, I would call the chickens are animals. Get the animals out of here. What are these animals doing? You know.
Now I gotta say, hearing some of the soundtrack to Disco Dancer, we haven't heard it in a little while, makes me realize how much I've missed it, and how
we
much
do another
this
viewing?
Song.
Just do another
I
viewing.
I will do you one better and say, why do we do anything else? Why do we do anything but watch Disco Dancer?
We were trying to find another Bollywood movie.
Yeah,
to
I thought we had one lined
watch
up.
It. Yeah, but
we got
to
get on
Disco
it. I've been in a lot of touch with Anubhav Pal lately, and I think he'd be ready for it. And I've been
he
in
just
touch
got
with
some. He's doing some show for BBC, right?
He did like a radio special. I listened to it. It was great. Yeah, it's called The Empire. I listened to it just yesterday, I believe. I think it was yesterday. What is time? But I know I listened to it this weekend. It may have been the day before.
That's circle.
But I did listen to it. It's great. Stephen Fry's in it. Anubhav's in it.
Oh, wow.
You know what? As I've been doing this whole pandemic, not to brag, but, you know, I've been just globetrotting with my movie watching. And I'll go in these phases. And I just went down a wild finished movie wormhole over the weekend.
Okay. What'd you get?
And I'm not afraid to say I'm still in it. I watched, have you guys seen, has anyone, and I defer to, by the way, hello to the chat, where all sorts of people, it's just heating up. Elvira Canavera, Matt Arnold, Dave Bamundo, Tracy Dunbar, Michael Braun. I'm just flipping through reading names. We have the super chat, which is super futuristic, exciting feature where you can pay cash money to make your comment jump out in an aggressive manner,
and have us talk about it.
What's that?
And have us talk about it.
Yeah, and have us discuss it in great detail.
Part of the social contract. Yeah.
Really, it's just a great way to support the show if you would like to see the show continue, which I threaten daily to stop doing.
He does.
It lives and dies on the super chat. But no. So I watched Leningrad Cowboys Go America. Has anyone seen it?
No.
Have you seen the sequel, Leningrad Cowboys Go Moses?
Do I have to know what? Do I have to have seen the first one in order to understand the sequel, or can I kind of jump in?
It would be helpful.
Okay.
I mean, you could.
In the event that I come across the sequel first, I want to know.
They're both on Criterion Collection. If you belong to that, if you're signed up for that, and then I have 20 minutes left on another Finnish movie because I liked the star of Leningrad Cowboys. I was like, you know what? I'm going to find every movie available that this guy's in, and I'm going to watch it.
Nice.
And I found two others, both Finnish movies. I'm just saying that's where it's at with me. If it's not a Finnish movie, I have no interest.
Not interested.
At least for the next 24 hours. And then I'll go back to watching. I'll probably watch Disco Dancer.
You know what I watched for the first time ever the other night? Psycho 2. Have you ever seen that?
Like, is that with Vince Vaughn? No.
30
years. No. That was the remake. No, they made a sequel to Psycho with Anthony Perkins in like early 80s.
85, somewhere around there, yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds like a money grab.
It was actually really good, though. I was really into it.
Can you turn the music down a tiny bit? Not that I'm not enjoying it, because I am. The number here is 201-584-7071. Now that we have Dez here, I mentally didn't give out. Anyway, it's not. Backstory is not important. 201-584-7071. Call. We have amazing guests tonight.
I'm psyched.
I'm just jumping off. Low blood sugar. I'm all over. The authors of the new book, which is out tomorrow. It comes out in hardcover, I believe. I have the advance copy in paperback because I'm very famous. Nothing But a Good Time. It's about Rat, Motley Crue, Poison, on down the line.
I believe today is Bret Michaels' birthday, so it's very timely. Good booking.
It is. Yeah. I did not know that.
Twitter told me.
This book, Skid Row, Twisted Sister, Winger, you heard me, Warrant, Cinderella. It's like all in here.
It's like a metal edge in your lap. The 20th
yes. Century. Questions answered. New ones raised. I mean, I'm not done with it. It's a thick tome. I mean, it's fucking really big book, I'd have to say. It's over 500 pages.
Is that kind of like the Our Band Could Be Your Life of 80s hair metal?
I would argue that it is.
It's good to see the 80s scene get some respect. Long overdue.
Respect is a strong word.
Noticed? How about that?
I just appreciation? Flipped,
paid attention to,
I think.
You know, I...
Acknowledged?
I just flipped to the acknowledgments to see whether... I just by accident, honestly. And, I'm not thanked, which not that I was expecting to, but it's just when you accidentally flip to acknowledgments and realize you have not been acknowledged.
Make
now,
because
I, that. As just the guy who's, as an author of three books so far, I tend to thank too many people. I'm too grateful to too many people. Now, these guys, they just had one page of acknowledgments and I wasn't one of them. That's not important. No, I'm kidding. I'm not kidding about not being acknowledged. I'm joking about expecting to be acknowledged because I don't. I'm not.
No.
My point. Bullet Boys.
Smooth up in ya.
Smooth up in ya.
Yeah.
I found myself in a Bullet Boys discussion yesterday, I think.
Who's that? Mark Torian was the singer there?
Yeah, Mark Torian's name came up.
With a Q.
Because he... how did this come up? I think because I posted about this book yesterday, I think. I can't remember days anymore.
Your mid-pant.
Some, I was DMing with someone who told me that Mark Torian was in Rat briefly. That's going to be a question. That's going to be probably my first question out of the gate to these guys.
Nice.
It's all in there. Bullet Boys open for Cheap Trick, Matt Arnold says. Even now, and I read it, even though, no, it was not using the Super Chat. I'm not saying I'll only read Super Chat comments.
Matt did Super Chat a few minutes prior to that, so.
Oh, he did. I didn't see it.
He didn't have a comment, so.
Just chatting.
It works out. Works out. I got a call if you want to take it.
Yeah, let's take it.
Call.
Wait, I should say.
Fine, folks.
Wait, real quick. I'm not done. I didn't. Wait, hang on. Hank, shut up.
Hold on, Elvar. I got him down.
I forgot to say who the guests are in all my excitement about the book. The guests are the author of the book, Tom Bozier and Richard Beanstalk. Tom Bozier and Richard Beanstalk are going to be joining us in 10 minutes. Authors of Nothing But a Good Time. I'm sorry, Elvira, for yelling at you. I was really yelling at myself for saying their names.
I understand. You have a lot of built-up pressure, and I'm just here to help you. What I wanted to talk to you, since we're talking about metal, was I've been loving the Taint. I am becoming one with the Taint. The Witch Taint has become my life.
Oh, Witch Taint, yeah. It's one of the greatest bands of all time.
What are you doing in 2021?
What is Witch Taint doing? I'll tell you, Witch Taint, we just booked a show for 2021. Will it happen? I don't know.
Where?
But we are supposed to be playing in New York City in September.
Yeah.
That's all I'll tell you. I'll just leave it at that.
That should work.
We're playing in New York City, and we're booked to play in New York City in September. It's going to be our record release party a full year and a half after the record came out.
Nice.
Roughly. pretty much a year and a half after.
Weren't you supposed to have a release party like last April?
Yeah, but I don't know if you've been following the news, Chris.
No, I know, but I'm just saying, like, that's how long ago it was.
yeah. The record came out as, you know, I've been kicking myself because I don't have a new record of anything ready to go. And then I remembered, I said, Dave, you've released three albums this year. Yeah. Or in 2020, I released three albums, Witch Taint, Painted Doll, and then my stand-up album. Witch Taint was the first one.
Apple Music.
Yes, it's true. But yeah, Witch Taint was the first one, April 20th, and we were supposed to do a record release party. It was supposed to be a who's who of... who was going to be there? Mark Torian from the Bullet Boys, Brett Michaels from Poison. No, but yeah, we were supposed to do it, and then the Coco 19 happened. This is a name I came up with today. I've already coined pre-pandy and post-pandy to refer to the times before and after the pandemic in a way that's more fun.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it is a way to move on from the when once we're truly safe and once it's truly behind us. This could be a few years from now. We refer to COVID-19 as Coco 19 to just, you know, render it a little powerless. Coco 19. That was back in the days of Coco. Do you think it can catch on, Elvira?
Wasn't there?
I got vaccinated today. I got my first shot.
Were you
did?
Listening?
It was such an. Yeah, I.
It was vaguely on topic.
My third attempt, but I never thought I would actually find a sense of hope in that Walmart of all places.
Oh well, I was right there with you. I've been in Walmart a total of three times in my life. And what they have done,
headache.
If you were looking for flattering lighting, it's not the place to go. But I will say I went into Walmart. I needed capers. And close-minded Dave was just like, they're not going to have capers at Walmart. These Philistines. Bought capers. No problem. They had them. They had two different kinds.
Did you have to ask where they were?
No.
My wife is found them. Capers. It's a regular topic at our house.
I even got some craft brews.
Oh. Yeah. That's the kind of thing that like I would never want to ask, hey, where are the capers in a Walmart? Because I know exactly the response I'm going to get. What are capers? What are you talking about?
Well, that's you being, I think you're stereotyping.
No, I would say that even like when I would go into a Radio Shack when I needed some kind of adapter.
Why would you get capers at a Radio Shack?
No, I'm not saying I would get capers at a Radio Shack. I'm saying if I went to like a Radio Shack, even then I would be like, whatever I ask for, they're not going to know what the hell I'm talking about.
What do you think, you're better than everyone who works retail, Chris?
At Radio Shack. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I gotta say, early early days of the pandy, being out here in Ohio, I like a character in a bad romantic comedy where the city people move to the country. I asked for pate at the grocery store, and I got some funny looks for that. And I even said, do you have, I don't eat pork. It has to be chicken liver pate. So please don't point me towards the pork pate, because that's not what I'm after. And they get in a look and just shaking their head, they said so much.
Yeah.
With great disdain.
Would liverwurst pass if you couldn't get your hands on a pate?
Yeah, totally. And I wouldn't even know the difference.
Yeah, that's a working man's meat.
That's fine. Yeah. I got no problem with that. So all by way of saying, I have not had pate in over a year. My life is hell. So which vaccine did you get, Elvira?
I got the Pfizer.
Did you know the Pfizer vaccine is actually is just a beef bouillon cube and a little bit of Fresca? That's all it is.
And a prayer to Jesus. You got to have the prayer for it to work.
No, it's just those two. It's bouillon, beef bouillon and Fresca. The Moderna one is the Shamrock Shake. Mm. And Johnson & Johnson is Tab. It's Tab, the discontinued diet cola. That's all it is. Did you notice that?
Okay.
Look it up. Look up the timeline for when Tab was discontinued and when Johnson & Johnson announced they were working on a vaccine. The dates slam right into each other.
Like look conspiracy it up. Conspiracy theory, Dave.
Mm-hmm. I'm just saying, well, this is, you know, I'm just scrambling, just trying. I'm flailing, just trying to find an audience. So I'm walking the line, you know. I'm just saying, let's be slightly skeptical for no good reason. You know, because the super chat's not working. I'm going to be a conspiracy theorist because the super chat's not working. And we're not going to be able to continue this show.
Two underexploited areas of witch taint.
Oh, Jesus.
One is the lullaby music of the songs. Because when you're a new parent, you can play lullaby music of metal songs, and the kid just gets a quiet little chimes, but inside your head, you're rocking out to Dio.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't you just, Chris, what happened to your camera?
Is a live rock anthem for an underappreciated part of every concert venue. A rock anthem for the merch table.
Hmm. I'll think about it. I'm going to think long and hard about it.
I'm surprised Gene Simmons has worked.
Because as a stagehand, I work with all sorts of folks, and often it's the merch table people that are completely crapped on. I'll be yelled at for helping them sometimes. And you know you're on a good tour when the merch person is a happy person.
fuck the merch person. No, just kidding. I'm just being contrary. Where did Chris go?
And that's also where a lot of the money is these days.
I think maybe, didn't he go to tend to our guests?
Oh, I know. That's exactly where he went. You would think, as a guy who knows the inner workings of this show,
got to go down the hall.
Easily, maybe the third best.
I think he went to go apologize to some merchandise folk he was very mean to.
No, I love the merchandise people. Well, Elvira, thank you. We're about to bring our guests on.
I appreciate you, fine folks.
Keep up the good work. Thank you for listening. Which
are better with you in it.
Congratulations on getting the vaccination.
We're halfway back to doing live shows again.
There you are.
By 2023, no question.
And I'll still be wearing a mask.
All right. Good night, Elvira.
Good night. Or call back with your hair metal question.
20 minutes.
Folks, it's me, James Arthur M., host of Minority Corner, your home through these wild times for weekly doses of pop culture, history, news, nerdy stuff, and more through a BIPOC queer and allied lens.
Y'all, we have been in a panorama for a whole year.
The Ponda replay has been going for... We've been a Ponderosa for a year.
Wonder Woman doesn't even get to fly her own invisible jet. That was another thing. I was like, this is your jet.
Think about the war on drugs. We must think of it as a war on black and brown and poor people only uphold the caste system of America. So join me and some of your new BFFs every Friday here on Maximum Fun to stay informed, empowered, and have some fun. Minority Corner, because together we're the majority.
I'm Judge John Hodgman.
And I'm Bailiff Jesse Thorne.
10 years ago, I came on Jordan Jesse Go and judged my first dispute. Is chili a soup? It's a stew, obviously.
The judge has dispensed a decade of justice. He's the one person wise enough to answer the really important questions. Like, should you hire a mime to perform at your own funeral?
After they cry, I want them to laugh.
Do you really need a tank full of jellyfish in your den?
They smell like living creatures decaying.
Only if they are decaying.
Yeah, which they will be.
Real people, real justice, real comedy.
Winner of the Webby Award for Best Comedy Podcast.
The Judge John Hodgman Podcast, every Wednesday on MaximumFun.org.
Now my microphone's cutting in and out. What a shit show. Are you there, Dennis?
Yeah, I'm here. Been here the whole... Yeah.
I don't know where we lost... I see our guests are... They're lurking.
There.
There's Chris.
Hey.
Chris, are you back?
I'm back.
Where are our guests?
They're backstage. They're ready to go whenever
oh, they're ready to go. I'm looking at the wrong screen. It looked like they were... like stuck in another dimension, but
your mic is doing that thing again.
I'll get rid of it. Let me just get rid of it. Who are we kidding? I'm gonna get rid of it because it sucks.
Thought it could have been me, but I didn't want to.
How's that?
There you go.
Is that better?
It's a little better.
It doesn't sound any better.
That sounds better. It's not crackling, that's for sure. Sounds great in that sense.
That's just my computer.
Yeah.
Oh my God. This is why we need people to use the super chat.
Matt Arnold was actually...
Oh, Niels Rush. Oh, this is our first... Dave Fix Audio. See, people use the super chat when I have technical difficulties. Maybe I should do that more often.
This is
why we need the support, because we have horrible equipment. The number here is 201-584-7071. Let's bring our guests on. They are authors of the incredible new book. I have an advanced copy. You can get yourself
a fancy hardcover copy available tomorrow. Pre-order it tonight or I'll fucking stab you. It's called Nothing But a Good Time, as I've mentioned before. The uncensored history of the 80s hard rock explosion. It features a foreword by Corey Taylor of Slipknot. Take that, Amanda Gorman. Her book, does her books don't have forewords by Corey Taylor? Can you imagine that if Amanda Gorman's books, all of a sudden, you got her like, oh, she's just amazing. She read this amazing poem at the inauguration. Oh, well, the singer for Slipknot did the foreword. I didn't see that coming. Anyway, Nothing But a Good Time. It's a great book. I'm knee deep in it now. The authors, Tom Bozier, Richard Beanstock, they walk among us. Let's let them on the show. Oh, we should have had some hair metal cute. Oh my God.
Nice.
You guys look incredible. You guys look. Chris, can you turn the music down? I just want to take all this in. This is one of those times when, even though this show is mostly ingested in podcast form, anyone seeing it visually tonight is getting an extra special treat because you guys both look incredible. Tom, you look like you've just been freed from a dungeon of some sort.
I have let the beard go full maximum.
You seriously, you look amazing. Your hair and beard are really, Richard, you look great. I'm not lumping you in. You look like you've had access to sanitary conditions.
I try, yes.
Or should I call you Rich?
You can call me Rich. It's quicker.
Okay. I'll go back. Full disclosure, you know, I don't want anyone to think I'm trying to hide this, but Tom is in Paint a Doll with me, and his alter ego is also in Witch Taint with my alter ego, which had nothing to do with them securing this booking.
Nothing at all.
Nothing at all. I would have wanted to anyway, because this book is incredible. I say this I'm not done with it because it's 7,000 pages, and that's not me complaining. That's me grateful for the reading ahead. It's over 500 pages, and I am knee deep in it, and it just keeps delivering I almost put the book down. There's a story about now this is when it's 8:38 and I'm combining names of members of Great White, but Jack, the singer from Great White, what's his last name?
Russell.
Jack Russell. I was combining Jack Russell and Mark Kendall, even though any reasonable person will tell you they no longer play in a version of the band together. But there's a story in there, and this is just, first of all, the dirt is like a fucking children's book compared to this book.
That was
the dirt. First of all, I called bullshit on that book 15 years ago, whenever it came out. I called bullshit on it then, saying it's not that good. And I'm glad that maybe took me a little while to wait around for it, but a book came along that basically makes the dirt its fucking bitch. And it's this book, Nothing But a Good Time. I, interest of full disclosure, did a blurb for this book, which you can see on the, it's not on this advanced copy, which I'll ask about soon, but it is on the regular copy. But I think this book, if you're looking for the truth about hard rock, heavy metal, glam metal, hair metal, and you want salacious tales, this book kicks the dirt up and down the street like a bag of dog shit, basically. And you can put that on the second printing. But there's a story about Jack Russell from Great White. I mean, you guys wrote the book, you know. But he is high on all sorts of drugs and goes into someone's house and holds the maid at gunpoint.
And he shoots the maid.
Yes. He shoots the maid.
What? Accidentally.
Accidentally.
Let's say that. It's the craziest. If it's not an indictment of about 50 million things that I, for in order to keep things light, to not even get into, but the fact that the singer of Great White, who first really took over the airwaves with a song called Rock Me, I think, the fact that he shot somebody and then went on not only to not really have to pay any consequences, but to be the singer for a shitty band and a successful and pretty shitty band.
This is maybe that was the consequence.
The consequence that he wasn't great. Yeah. I shouldn't take shots at Great White. They're great at what they do. It's just not my thing.
Yeah, and I like Great White. The thing about, I mean, the story is mind blowing. I would also say, and I don't say this in a way to disparage Jack Russell in any way, but when he told this story, he actually started sort of getting like choked up telling it and had difficulty telling it. And I think because, like, but he wanted to tell it, and he wasn't trying to, you know, glamorize it, but it was just this crazy thing that happened. And even, you know, shooting this maid is crazy enough in itself. He's high on PCP at the time. Then he like blacks out and he wakes up and like the SWAT team's there. Like, it just gets crazier and crazier. And then the thing is, like, yeah, he gets out of JV or, you know, juvenile detention, whatever he's in, and starts playing with Great White again. And he's like, you know, he's been sort of out of the world for a little while. He talks about how he shows up for the first gig. He's wearing like Jordache jeans or some shit. And they're like, what the hell are you wearing? You know, because like even styles had changed.
And he said, I don't know if you remember, but I shot a maid. And that's why I've shown up to the gig dressed in a way that's maybe not cool enough for you guys.
That's the most offensive thing, like the clothes he's wearing, you know, beyond what he actually did. But yeah, it's just this insane story that gets more insane as it goes on.
I think it's important to point out, though, that he doesn't do this when he's like 32.
No. Yeah, he's a very young.
Yeah.
He's 36 at the time.
So let's be clear, as history has shown us, Jack Russell would go on to do many stupid things throughout the decades to follow, but
all accidentally, actually,
yeah. All accident, many unfortunate. I know. I feel bad that I'm any shots I'm taking at Jack Russell or Great White are just, I'm joking around. I have nothing against him or the band, but it is a cautionary tale. He doesn't, yeah, he's not like laughing like, oh yeah, I was on PCP and it's like, it's heavy. But my point is, A of all, much better than the dirt, not just because that story, but because there's a million stories throughout the book that are amazing. But also the kind of stuff you don't necessarily associate with what a lot of people dismiss as just kind of good time party rock music. You think, well, no one in any of these bands shot someone while high on PCP, but they did. Anyway, I'm not going to talk about that story all night. That was the one that really, it takes your head off very early in the book.
You know, the thing is most of the, you know, this book is in the oral history format. So it's all short quotes that are like 200 words long or something. But this is the one case where we just let it run. I think it's like we didn't even interrupt. We didn't, there's nothing. It just, we just let 1200 words of this occurrence.
It's amazing. I mean, I'm, you know, not to, you know, not to Monday morning quarterback this whole book, but you could have just been like, the singer for Great White shot a maid while high on PCP and other stories.
Where were you a year ago?
Wait, are you asking me that?
Yes, you could have helped us. You could have saved us so much time.
This thing, yeah.
No. I thought you were at, like, where... It's like, where were you when John Lennon was shot? Where were you when Jack Russell shot the maid? Well, it's harder. You don't stop in your tracks and go, I know exactly where I was when Jack. But no, I'm not going to harp on this all. But we were debating before you guys came on. We were debating. I referred, not that this book, it's the 80s hard rock explosion, which is, because I was reading the bands, some of the bands in the book, like there's great distinctions between Van Halen, Motley Crue, Winger, Warrant. To me, just even right there, that's like spanning oceans apart. But some people, where did you guys draw the line?
Well, I don't think we were originally even planning. The original plan was to go 81 to 91, like from Motley Crue, Too Fast for Love,
mm-hmm.
and end it like roughly when Nevermind comes out. But sort of once we started interviewing these bands, you start realizing that of the first wave of bands, they really were 70s bands that didn't get signed till the 80s. So like when Van Halen's on the strip, when they about to get signed, you know, George Lynch from Dokken is already kicking around and he's in a band, and Quiet Riot are already around. So you actually kind of have to start at that era of like, you know, 77, 78, because all these guys, Nikki Sixx was around, you know, like the Rat guys are floating around. So they're all there at that time, and they all think they're going to get signed right after Van Halen gets signed, and then they don't.
Yeah. I mean, they had to, like, yeah, it is pretty amazing because, yeah, like you forget that all these, I mean, because by the time Dokken, I mispronounce it. I know you're supposed to say, do you say Dokken? Like, Rockin', Dokken.
Yes, rhymes with Rockin'.
I say more Dokken. I don't know why, but I can. That's all I can bring my. And I say that as a fan. But like by the time Dokken is like on MTV's top 10 videos of the day or whatever, with In My Dreams from the third album, Under Lock and Key, for example. George Lynch is already 68 years old by the time that happened.
He's definitely not 22.
No, he's not that old, but he's like
33.
I remember, he was in his 30s. And yeah, you forget that like, while we think of this as like 80s music, that's totally true. It's like it's really, as you said, story of 70s music, of guys that, like, it's amazing how many bands these guys were all in, like 78 bands before they like hit the you know, their stride.
Yeah, and especially in the LA scene, because it's so tight-knit, you know. I mean, to bring up Dokken again, Dokken and Rat
especially. I'm knowing you can bring up Dokken and Rat all non-stop with me.
But, you know, those guys like Juan Crucier is in Dokken, and then he's in Rat, and then he's sort of back in Dokken, but then he's back in Rat. And, you know, when George Lynch goes to try out for Ozzy's band, Warren DeMartini from Rat sort of goes and starts playing with Dokken because they share a rehearsal space. Bobby Blotzer from Rat is playing in a band with Don Dokken in the 70s, and you know, even at that time, like Bobby Blotzer meets Don Dokken and he's like, I can't believe how old this dude is. And then, at that time, Don Dokken's like 22. But it just shows how young a lot of these guys were when they're started. You know, Bobby Blotzer is probably 18. And he thinks he's like in a band with his grandpa.
But that's how I remember when you're that age, you know.
Yeah, totally.
That is 4 years older when you're that age is old as shit. It's unfathomably old.
Yeah.
When you're 18, a 22-year-old is old as fuck.
You're like, there's no way we're getting signed with this dude in the band, man.
Yeah. I mean, I remember my first band, which was, you know, after this era, because I'm quite young. The singer was 2 years older than the rest of us, and we would, like, have private conversations about that. We'd be like, this guy's fucking really old. Are we sure we want to stick with this guy? He's 2 years older than us.
Pays rent.
What's that?
He pays rent.
Exactly.
I mean, and the guy, even on the East Coast too, I mean, the guys in Twisted Sister have been playing covers since the early 70s, and like our D. Snyder did the math and he explained to us that, like, adjusted for inflation, like in 1980, he was making like $250,000 a year.
No, it's like I have it right here. It's like even more than that. It's like 300 and some thousand. It's some insane amount of money. Also, I think with Twisted Sister and Van Halen, they both sort of exhibit the Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours rule by being cover bands that just play nonstop.
I think a lot of these, Quiet Riot, the band that breaks all of this open in 1983, you know, they're at the 10 million hours at that point, I think. I mean, they've been a band for 10 years. They had Randy Rhoads. They were signed. Then they weren't signed. Then they lose Randy Rhoads. Then Kevin Dubrow is playing to no one for probably 3 or 4 years as the band Dubrow. And then finally gets his big break. I mean, they were, without a doubt, considered has-beens at that point. And then here they are as like the leaders of this new youthful movement, you know, and they're like, they've been around since 73, 74.
And you can see Kevin Dubrow's hairline is, by the time he's back to about here, by the time Come On, Feel the Noise hits MTV,
When QR3 comes out, though, he's got a glorious head of hair, which just shows you that if you have a sextuple platinum record, anything is possible. The world is your oyster, Dave.
I know. He really did all of a sudden get an amazing hairline. The weird thing was, this is, and I apologize, I don't think this is addressed in the book. But one thing I always hear about, and I know I'm jumping around. By the way, everyone, if you have not pre-ordered this book, Nothing But a Good Time, by the time this podcast version comes out Friday, it'll already be out and hopefully be on the bestseller list, because it's a page turner. And I think it will be, I can't say it enough. I really do think people will throw their copies of The Dirt in the garbage, because it's bullshit compared to this book. And I have read literally pretty much every rock book in existence, so I would know. But what I wanted to say about Quiet Riot, and Tom, you and I maybe have had this conversation before, but Rich, let me get your opinion. Quiet Riot always claims that the Come On, Feel the Noise, which is a Slade cover, they're always like, yeah, we just, that's actually our first take. We just kind of banged it out really fast. They're really dismissive about, you know, they don't seem to have a lot of reverence for one of the greatest songs by one of the greatest bands of all time, Slade. And but then when you listen to their version, they've done a new arrangement of it, which busts their bullshit lie wide open. Because there's no breakdown before the guitar solo. They act like they just listened to the Slade version and then just banged out one take. It's a lie. Where do you guys stand on this? You don't even have to comment if you feel like you're wading into controversial waters.
Do you want to take this?
Thanks, Rich. I would, it's in the book. It's discussed in several ways that whether they arranged it or not is not discussed. But like whether or look in the book, the way it goes down is this guy, Spencer Proffer, who's like a producer in L.A. of what had he done? He had done like some Rich.
But he did. He did the Tina Turner Acid Queen record. I remember
right,
that.
Right. And so he's like looking around for a hard rock band. And he goes to Quiet Riot, who are down on their luck, and he's like, look. And he's heard the Slade version on the radio. And he says, you know, like, all I need, if I can find a band to do this song the right way, I'm going to be a bazillionaire. And so he finds Quiet Riot, and he has them come to the studio. And basically, he's like, I will record a record for you, but you have to do this song. It's his, you know, his devil's deal. You're going to like, and so.
This is straight up old blues man shit.
Yeah. You know, this is like Trejo Lee Coco.
I was just going to say that.
There's a Fame reference. So they go to the studio and according it we obviously didn't speak to Kevin Dubrow because he's no longer with us, but you know, they know that they have to do this song to get the studio time. They didn't discuss with us, although if we were going back in time right now, I think that would be a great question to ask them. Like, so you changed the arrangement of the song, like you must have worked on it some. And you know what, Carlos, we spoke to Carlos and Rudy and stuff. One of them, somebody would have answered, but the legend is that when they go into the studio, they try and throw the game. It's like, we're going to do this song. We're going to do it shittily enough that nothing will come of it. And we'll still get to record our songs.
Yeah.
So, you know, but when they start playing, their musician's pride kicks in and they just kick the shit out of it. And then Kevin Dubrow is backed into a corner. And it, you know, this is our version of the story. And Kevin Dubrow yells at the band, like, why did you do that? You played it too good. Now they're going to like it. And then he goes in and does a killer vocal because he doesn't want to seem like the chump. And he nails it. Mm-hmm. Having said all this, right, the thing is looking at it from then versus now, where it became the biggest hit in the world and the Quiet Riot record knock Synchronicity out of the number one spot. Like back then they were still a has-been band, like doing a sketchy spec deal for a dude who had a couple phone numbers at Epic Records. So it's a weird thing because between like them just recording this song because they said they would, and then Epic Records finally deciding after saying, we don't want to put this record out because it sucks, and Spencer Proffer being like, please put it out, and them doing it, and then MTV running the video and it becoming the biggest song in the world. Like, there's so many things fall into place to make what was like this probably minor 30-minute experience into the song that actually launched this whole era. That you can understand why then they have to go back and figure out why they did it and how they did it. Like, they probably, I would posit this, that they probably almost didn't remember recording it.
Yeah. Because of cocaines.
The cocaines, but also because it was just like, all right, we're going to go to this dude's studio and do some songs. Like, it wasn't like, okay, we've been signed and Walter Yetnikoff really wants us to do this song, and if we do it, then we're going to go on tour with Aerosmith. They were just like a bunch of dudes getting the last free studio time they ever thought they were going to get in their life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very strange.
And the thing about the oral history too is you get all different perspectives. So we talked to Spencer Proffer, the guy producing them and whose grand idea this was. And we asked him that question, did they fuck it up on purpose? And he's like, they didn't fuck it up at all. They played it, they killed it. He's like, they were professionals. So I think, you know, what the guys in Quiet Riot are relating to us, or it's more like, it's more a feeling that they had, you know, because they, of course they played it great. Like they've been clawing through shit for 10 years. Like they're not going to fuck up this chance, even if it's, the chance seems very slim at the time. But when they tell this story, I think it's more like they clearly went in there. They didn't want to do this song, whether or not they played it great or messed it up on purpose. I think the truth is that they just didn't want to do it, but they knew that they had to. So I think the truth is somewhere in between, like, they were forced to do it. They acknowledge that. They probably played it great because it was their last shot.
I know. I mean, now as we're talking about it, I'm replaying the song in my head and I'm thinking like, oh, Frankie Vinali starts off with that beat, which is not in the Slade version. Let me be clear. They all do amazing. They all play amazingly well and do all these super cool things that improve the song that are not in the Slade version. And as a huge Slade fan, I couldn't tell you which version I prefer. They both are magical. Now I'm doing that thing. Before I was like, I'm not going to talk about Jack Russell shooting the maid all night long. Now I won't shut up about one Quiet Riot song. But all by way of illustrating what an amazing and engaging book this is that everyone should buy, or I'll fucking stab you. That's going to be my quote again. Nothing but a good time. I'm holding it, even though 99.9% of people will hear this in podcast form and not see me wearing the sweater or holding the book up. Everyone should go get it. Who do you guys have a favorite person and or anecdote from the book?
Favorite anecdote is probably the Jack Russell anecdote, because
you didn't let me finish. Aside from the Jack Russell anecdote, if you couldn't tell that one, say that.
I think that there's a very interesting sort of back and forth, and it's not one I've thought about before, but it's popping into my head now, about the recording of the first Bang Tango record. We're going to go all the way to the other end of the 80s in this. And there's a whole story, just like with the Quiet Riot thing, about differing opinions on what happened as to whether during the recording of that record, a woman was thrown through a plate glass window or not.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So the producer believes that this did happen, although he did not see it firsthand. And the producer is Howard Benson, who then goes on to become a major player in the industry, producing for My Chemical Romance and All American Rejects. He produces some Kelly Clarkson stuff. He is like a major guy now. But at the time, he is super green. Some of his first records are the first Bang Tango record. Then he goes right after, he does the first Pretty Boy Floyd record. Then he does the first Tough record. So he is like full on in this stuff.
T-U-F-F.
Of course. Yeah. Correct. How else do you spell?
Can I just interrupt you quickly? A parallel that not a lot of people will pick up on: bass player for Tough, bass player for Keel, bass player for Badlands, all brothers, three brothers with each other.
Are you serious?
Look it up.
I don't even know how to pronounce the name, so I'm not.
Chason, the Chason brothers.
There you go. Wow.
Oh, wow.
Thanks. Yep. This is just a form of autism coming out that I have for this. For also Bang Tango evolved into a band called Beautiful Creatures, featuring guitar player DJ Ashba, who wound up in Guns N' Roses.
There you go.
And 6 a.m.
Yes, and 6 a.m. and 6 a.m. But that's an interesting Bang Tango, a lesser known player in this tangled web.
Yes.
How many records? How many bands? Two Bang Tango records?
Two, yes. And then, I mean, ones that came out later and that were maybe recorded earlier. But yeah, at the time, they had the two. And it was during the first one where this incident supposedly happened.
No spoilers, mm-hmm. but can you break it down for us?
Well,
you don't have to.
Yeah, in a nutshell. So Howard Benson, the producer who was very young and new at the time, he takes them, I believe, I'm going to say to Texas to record this record. I forget why he goes to Texas, but he does. And so this is 1988 in somewhere in Texas, and these guys are walking around
in a college town.
In their, yeah, a college town in Texas, and they're full on in their Sunset Strip regalia, and they are, I guess, having their way with the college women in this town. And even though they don't even have a record at this point, but that doesn't really matter because they look like they do.
They look like the members of the Bang Tango.
Exactly.
Because so they are.
There's a party that goes on at their rented condo or something one of the nights. There's stuff that goes on in the studio that is sort of alluded to, but no one really wants to talk in depth about it in 2020. But Howard Benson goes to their condo the next day. The whole front window is shattered. And the story that comes out is things got wild. And one of the women, maybe from the college, went through it the night before. One of the guys in Bang Tango claims now that this was a story just made up to freak out Howard Benson at the time. Howard Benson is not so sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Well, we can only hope that everyone was okay and learned from whatever happened.
Yes.
But again, to my point, lots of stuff you don't expect.
No, I mean, there's like a lot of weird. I mean, have you gotten to the docking part yet? The making of Tooth and Nail, Dave?
I've read a bit about docking, but I don't think I'm in the specifics of that. I've admittedly jumped around a little bit, but now I've since gone back and am now plowing through.
Reading it
the way it was intended, like the Bible.
I hope this won't be too laborious to explain, but my favorite story in the book.
There is no Dawkins story that's too laborious. Let's be clear.
One of the first interviews I did for the book was with the producer, Tom Werman, who, along with producing Dawkins, produced Motley Crue, Cheap Trick, Ted Nugent, Molly Hatchet, a player, as you would say. And he was like, Don Dawkins and George Lynch hated each other, you know, and he ends up quitting the record. But the reason he ends up quitting the record is that the engineer on the record, this guy, Jeff, what's his last name, Rich? Do you remember Jeff?
Jeff Workman.
Yes, Jeff Workman. And my friend John Aniello corroborates that Jeff Workman was basically would come into work in the studio in the morning, drink a six pack, do a couple lines, and then just continue to drink all day while he was recording bands. Apparently an amazing engineer. But Jeff Workman and the members of Dawkins start recording the producer, Tom Werman, on the sly while they're making this record, like his banter in the control room. And then at night, because they're on cocaine probably, and they've already worked 12 hours, but you know they need something else to do, this guy, Jeff Workman, starts editing together the things that Tom Werman has said in the studio to make it sound like Tom Werman wants to get it on with the guitarist George Lynch. So they would cut something together. They would be, and this is what they say in the book, they'd be like, hey, Tom, did you think that girl that we saw over there was hot, and they would take the word hot, and then be like, what did you think of George's solo? And then they would grab George. And so they cut together a tape that they that said, like, I think George is hot. I, you know, like, I want to bang George or whatever. They put together this tape that they then play for George Lynch of Dokken. And like, Tom Werman has the hots for you. And they play this completely manipulated tape for George Lynch. And George Lynch proceeds the next day while they're trying to cut a solo to freak out on Tom Werman. Like, Tom Werman telling him, like, oh, could you play something like maybe a little more melodic, whatever? And George Lynch is just like, fuck you, man. I know what you're up to. And he throws his guitar on the ground. He's like, bam. And then he gets up in Tom Werman's face. He's like, I'm going to fucking kill you. Blah, blah, blah. And Tom Werman's like, what? You want to hit me? You want to hit me? And Tom Werman makes it aside. It's like, often when you're in these situations, if you ask them if they want to hit you, it will diffuse the situation. And so George Lynch is like, fuck you, man. And Tom Werman's like, yeah, and then like George Lynch storms out of the studio and Tom Werman's like, what the fuck just happened? And calls Cliff Bernstein, the manager, who now manages Metallica but then managed Dokken, and is just like, I'm off this project, I'm giving you back a point, I'll see you later. And he leaves.
Wow.
And like, this is going on at like $200 an hour of studio time.
Wow.
So that's the kind of stuff that you really, the gold that you find when you're
behind this, in this river. Yeah.
Yes.
And it's also, this is a make and break album for Dokken, to make or break album. Like, they're, you know, if this doesn't work for them, this is probably it for them. And this is how they're handling it in the studio, which is insane.
Yeah. But, it worked out though, because they got a song. Wait, what was on that? Into the Fire?
I believe that's on there, and so is the ballad, the
Alone Again.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, you know, it sounds like a process that I wouldn't want to be involved in on any side of it, but they, you know, it all worked out. We have some super chat questions we need to get to.
I got a caller here as well, too.
Yeah, let's see. Niels Rush in Canada says, can you ask about the band Dead Engine, D-E-D Engine? I don't know how they factor into this, but do they?
I don't even know. You know what I'm doing right now?
Googling.
Yeah, I'm Googling them. Mm-hmm. Googling the shit out of this band.
That's I've D-E-D. Heard of them, I think.
Yeah. They're not
great.
They're not made. In the book. We had to make some tough choices making this book. And this was actually not one of the tough choices because we didn't really know to think to include them. But some bands did get left on the cutting room floor. And Dead Engine, I apologize to your message person, is one of them.
Niels Rush, I don't think it'll cost you the sale, but I don't think it's helping. No. Brendan O'Dwyer says, can we all have a meetup at Joel's Boiler Room when we get vaxxed? Oh, that's yes we can. Just answer that. I don't understand. Elvira Canaveral, did you guys meet in an alphabetical line? I don't get that question. Do you guys get anyone get that question?
We might be showing up in alphabetical order on YouTube. It's different than ours, so I don't know.
You know,
I think that's what it is. Yeah.
Can I say, Matt Arnold has probably, and shame on me for not asking this. I guess I did sort of ask this question in a very not succinct way. For Matt Arnold, this is a real question that an actual interview would ask an author. Matt Arnold asked, for the authors, that's Tom Bozier and Richard Beanstalk, authors of Nothing But a Good Time. He says, for the authors, what was your biggest surprise in your research? That's a real question.
I think one big surprise, the fact that this music in the early part of the decade was so unwanted by the labels and the mainstream. I think growing up at that time, to me, it seemed like this new, fresh, and really like hot thing that everybody was into. But what you get from these guys who were there, especially in the very early 80s, is that nobody wanted anything to do with it. It was considered dinosaur music. Rudy Sarzo from Quiet Riot says as much. And like the labels wanted punk bands, they wanted new wave bands, they wanted the Knack and the Go-Go's and all that stuff. And like they just saw this as like a retreat of what was going on in the 70s. And so one of the things that resulted from that in the book is this idea that people think of this music, whether you call it hair metal or glam or whatever, as this very corporate, slick produced thing with the big hair and the look and the videos and all this stuff. But really it comes from this very DIY, you know, just figure it out on your own sort of place where these bands were putting out their own records and just doing whatever they could in the clubs to like put on a show for people. And like nobody wanted to give them the time of day. No one wanted to help them until much later in the decade. And I think that Tom and I I'll speak for myself, but I think Tom felt the same way, that we sort of knew this, but we didn't know that it was to such an extent that this is the way it was for these bands.
You know, it's an interesting, you mentioned like punk rock. And I know Tom and I have had this conversation before, but you know, as dismissive as some people are of a lot of the bands, you know, sort of in this broad genre, but probably arguably people dismiss Poison the most, but a little Dave Hill couldn't have been more than 4 or 5 years old, saw Poison open up for Rat on the Under Lock and Key. No, not Under Lock and Key. This is where the Late Hour, that's the third Dawkin record. This is where it's 9:17 in my encyclopedic. No, the second Rat album is called
Dancing Undercover.
No, Dancing Undercover is the third Rat
Invasion
album.
Invasion of Your Privacy.
Invasion of Your Privacy, featuring the singles Lay It Down, You're in Love. Anyway, I saw them on that tour. Poison opened. I'd never heard of them before. They had a new album on Enigma Records called Look What the Cat Dragged In. And my buddy Tim and I saw them and we thought they were very funny. We couldn't tell if we were laughing with them or at them, but we loved them. We thought they were amazing at what they did. And then when Green Day like broke through with the Dookie album, I just did a little rewind in my head of a few years. And I thought, oh, this is basically Look What the Cat Dragged In, just a different version. It's the same. It's the same recipe. It's Twinkies and tiramisu. It's ultimately the same thing.
I mean, it's the success. You know, people are always like, power pop is never successful. You know, that's the... But actually, it is.
It's neither just powerful nor popular.
Yeah, except it is successful. It's just, it's Poison.
Yeah. That's,
you know,
yeah.
And Green Day probably, but that's, you know, and Cheap Trick before that. But it's interesting that you saw that tour, because
I saw it twice, let me be clear. And then I saw Poison again on the same album cycle, open up for David Lee Roth twice on the Skyscraper tour.
I saw that tour as well. I saw that tour at the Meadowlands. And that was the first time I saw Poison, and I thought that they were fantastic.
Well, that's the thing. Like, you know, some people hear us say this and they're probably like, you guys are out of your minds. But Poison on that first record was, they were amazing.
Yes. I mean, the thing, and the funny thing is about the Rat Tour, I mean, it's not that funny, and this may not be interesting, but I think it is because I wrote this book. Is
it's a great book. I can't stress that enough.
Poison makes their first record for Enigma, Look What the Cat Dragged In, and they make their first video for Cry Tough, and it stiffs. Well, it doesn't stiff, but the record sold like 200,000 records, which in today's metrics, you know, is fantastic. But back then, you know, Capitol Records had an interest in the band too. And they're like, all right, guys, you did great. We are going to get you to do another record. And basically, the guys in Poison themselves, and it's, they always took it upon themselves, go to Rat and get the Rat Tour. Because only if they get another tour will they be allowed to make another video. Mm-hmm. And so they get the Rat Tour, and by getting the Rat Tour are allowed to make the Talk Dirty to Me video, which is what blows them wide open. And which the video which they make for no money.
Yeah, and it's, and CC DeVille switched his guitars 78 times during the video, setting a precedent for that's the best thing you can do in a video.
Yes.
And also I remember going to my buddy Tim and I went to school, and we told everyone in our theology class about the Poison concert. The teacher was so captivated by our enthusiasm for this band Poison that we had seen, he yielded the floor and let us tell everyone in Catholic boys' school theology class about the Poison concert we had seen. 2 days in a row. He let us do this.
He let you preach Poison?
And everyone, because we were the only two kids in school who were omnivorous in that way in our musical listening, where we would go to that, and then we would go see the Replacements or whoever. Like, we would just see everything. So, but which, as you know, you're when you're 4 or 5 years old, you're not allowed to do that. But we did that. So when we were sitting saying how awesome Poison was, everyone's like, you're crazy. Like, you shouldn't even been at that concert. That's not cool. And we were like, just wait, they're going to be massive. And then, to your point, a little video called Talk Dirty to Me came out. And here we are now talking about them.
It's funny that you say that, because I actually had a cassette, and I've said this in a couple of interviews, but because it's true, that was Flip Your Wig on one side, Husker Du Flip Your Wig, and mm-hmm. Poison Open Up and Say Ah on the other side. And I just
for the listener, Open Up and Say Ah, the follow up to Look What the Cat Dragged In. Flip Your Wig, the follow up to
New Day Rising. But getting back to your original point, and then I'll shut up and let Rich talk some too. But
we have some calls on hold too.
I'll make this quick. No, you want me to shut up?
No. We just have a lot to pack into 7 minutes.
Okay. then I'll just shut up.
No, don't shut up. That was not me telling you to shut up.
No, but just DIY. I mean, and back to the 10,000 hours and the DIY. Poison, when they were still in Pennsylvania, because they were so young, they were doing the full punk rock thing. They were renting out VFW halls, renting a sound system, and packing it with kids. And by the time you see them on the road with Rat, they've sold out the country club, you know, a million times. They've done a million shows where they've done their own lights and props and all that stuff. They really did it all on their own for a long time. And that's why by the time you get to see them with a Rat, they've played 1,000 shows.
Yeah, so they've got it down.
Yeah.
I'm going to read some super chats real quick. I don't understand most of them. Elvira Canaveral says, Jack Russell Terrier?
Jack Russell Terrier?
No, he says Terrier, which I think is a reference to when Rich was saying he was tearing up This is an old super chat that I'm just getting to. I need to get to these real quick. A lightning round of super chats. Niels asks, does hair only extend to America? I don't understand that.
Hair metal?
Elvira asks, did women, and this is in the book, I know, right? Did women have crazy hair metal stories? Vixen, Vice, he says.
Yeah, I mean, they have their own stories. Like we, and that's why we have Vixen in there. We have Lita Ford. And we have a lot of women on the, you know, that weren't just artists. People like Sharon Osbourne are in there, who was obviously managing Ozzy and Lita for a time. There's costume designers in there who are the ones really creating a lot of these looks that have now become iconic, whether, you know, it's Motley Crue's Shout at the Devil look or Warren's looks. Like, we have these women, you know, who are sort of helping to shape the look of these men. I mean, the woman who worked on Motley Crue's looks at Kill video and Girls, 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 you know, and they have their own perspective on what was going on at the time. They don't, for the most part, go into, it's interesting. Like we tried to talk to them a little bit from the 2020 perspective of, I mean, things are different now and the way and cultural mores are different, but none of them really had anything that negative to say about their experiences back then. Actually, the people in the bands, like Vixen and Lita Ford, seemed to have a more difficult go of it, not surprisingly, than the people behind the curtain who were just kind of doing their job. One outlier would be, we spoke to a woman who was the quote unquote rack girl, RACK girl, for Wasp in the early days. Meaning she would go on stage at the Troubadour topless and have her head chopped off. Yeah, in a guillotine. And that was part of the show. And she was just someone who met the guys at a club. She thought that they were super creepy. She thought they were super old. You know, Blackie Lawless was another one of these guys from the 70s, had been in the New York Dolls and had been kicking around for a while. And she was, I think she was in college at the time. And she was approached to become this rack girl and went along with it. And, you know, there was this whole elaborate thing where it pretend that blood was spewing from her neck and she was topless. And she thought the whole thing was super creepy. And, you know, she just kind of did it because it was something to do. But I guess that's all to say, you do get many female perspectives in the book as well. And they sort of run the gamut from very happy and content with what went on and not so much.
Yeah. I can't recommend it enough. I'm going to plug it again before we only have a couple minutes left. Do we still have a call on hold?
Yes.
Let's grab it. What could possibly go wrong?
Dave, you there?
I'm here.
Yes. How you doing, guys?
It's Dave in Staten Island.
Oh, Dave in Staten Island. What's happening? We have a bit of a delay, it seems.
But I can confirm I was also at that David Lee Roth and Poison show, and if memory serves, I think Dave rode a flying surfboard like halfway through the audience to like a secondary stage at some point in that show.
That's accurate.
That's correct, yes.
The microphone.
But I have a White Lion based question, an anecdote.
You could not be in better hands.
Can you talk to the guys from White Lion?
We talked to everyone from White Lion. I even got to speak to Vito Bratta for like 3 hours.
Who is elusive.
Wow, that's my point, because I think he's like the guy that sort of fell off the face of the earth from that era.
He totally did. I got hooked up with him through email by Eddie Trunk, who was like, I'll give you his email. And I must have hit Vito Bratta on the right day. He emailed me back. And then once he realized that I had completely ingested every note that he had ever played and was a total fan. He was awesome. He like talked for 3 hours.
Wow.
He's funny. He's super cool. He still lives on Staten Island with his mom and a parrot. But like I'll say this though. He's not, there's not going to be, I don't think, he's not coming out. You know what I mean? He's not reemerging suddenly with an album. I think he's really kind of done. It was weird.
But so does he even play guitar anymore?
He said he'd kind of fucked up his hands, so he plays classical. Oh. Like he over shredded or something. So he plays classical, but he really hasn't played electric guitar in like a couple decades. He's really the one, like he says in the book, one of the things he says in the book is he's like, in the 90s, somebody came up to me and said, you know what your problem is? You play guitar too well. And he was like, what the fuck was I supposed to do with that? You know, like it really, he's one of the guys who really took it hard to be like thrown on the trash heap as these guys were in the 90s.
Yeah.
But a lovely dude. And if you're a Vito Bratta fan, there is maximum Vito in this book.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't skim.
I wonder if I kind of forced him into a little bit of retirement, because back in the day, my brother and I saw him. I think he was driving his white Eldorado. And we kind of chased him, and I ran up to his window at a red light and knocked on it for an autograph, which he gave me. But it was like, you know, maybe one of those freak out like moments, like, what the hell is this guy up to? So,
God damn it, Dave.
For his retirement.
Congratulations book, for ruining Vito Bratta. Way to go, Dave.
Yeah. Dave lives on Staten Island. I mean, this is... this could not be going better.
Yes.
This is peak.
Was a point of pride for quite some time, which I think is also the name of a White Line album.
It is Pride. Yes. Good album.
Pride with the hit single Wait, Let the Children Cry. Right. Not as strong. But thank you, Dave B.
Best of luck on the book.
Thank you.
Yeah, Dave, you got to buy this book. You'll love it. I should stress
all over it.
The book is great. I think the true test of as a guy who reads literally pretty much every rock book, I think the true test is when you can get into the book, when you don't have to be into the genre to enjoy the book. And I would say this book does that very well. I happen to be into the genre, which makes me like it even more. But I think anyone who likes music, who likes crazy stories, and just to learn the process of an artist who may or may not have shot a maid, it's an amazing book. Nothing but a good time. I'll say it again. The Uncensored History of the 80s Hard Rock Explosion, with a foreword by Corey Taylor from Slipknot. So there. And I will say, if you get the actual, not the advanced copy like I got, because I'm very famous, there's a blurb from me on the back. So just as if I haven't given you enough selling points for this book. No, but it's an amazing book. Congratulations. I think the way people talk about the Dirt, well, the way they talked about it for years and years as being such an amazing rock book, I think this, as I've said, kicks the shit out of the Dirt.
Well, thank you for the kind words, Dave.
I'm not just saying it. I've read the Dirt. I read the Heroin Diaries too. That you want to talk to a completist? I've read Nikki Sixx's Heroin Diaries. I read Steve Gorman from Black Crowes' book. I read Lita Ford's book. I read Greg Allman's book. I read both Duff McKagan books. You can't present me with a rock book that I have not read. So I speak from...
Have you read Bobby Blotzer's book?
That's the one I was going to bring up, too.
There's no Bobby. That wasn't that self-published.
It is a diamond in the rough. It's a good.
I don't read self-published rock books. I need to trust the industry. If the industry does not feel, if not even DeCapo Press will touch it, I shan't read it.
There's got to be a gatekeeper involved.
Yeah, there has to be. Someone has to. Yeah, before I'm gonna read it. I need something. Anyway, everyone get this book. It's amazing. Nothing but a good time. Thank you, Tom Bojour. Thank you, Rich Beanstalk.
Thank you very, very much. Thank you, Dave Bill.
Thank you, Chris Gersbeck. Thank you, New Jersey Chicken Ranger Dez.
Yeah,
you guys. Before we go, I also... Elvira Canaveral says antifashion at theoffensive.com. That's an email address. Niels Rush says Lee Aaron. I don't know what that refers to. We'll pick it up next week. Thank you for listening, watching. Keep up the good work, everybody. We're all counting on you.
Thanks, Dave.
Are we riding out to the sunset?
Yeah.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.